Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thanks for listening to the podcast from the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with us today. You know, sometimes you just flunk out of a job. And if you're Lulu, the black lab, you are out of a job. Poor little Lulu. This adorable black lab was hired by the CIA to sniff out explosives. He just wasn't that interested. Not that interested, says the dog sniffer. Wasn't up to snuff, and Lulu has been let go. Now, the CIA announced on its social media site that Lulu was interested in searching for explosives. Even when motivated with food and play, she was clearly no longer enjoying herself. The story does have a happy ending. Lulu was adopted by her handler and now enjoys playing and frolicking and sniffing out rabbits and squirrels in a new backyard. So there's a happy story. All right, celebrity break-ins. Mariah Carey is the latest. She was targeted by a burglar. Okay, this is a rough day for her. Fortunately, she was not home, but the burglars broke into the singer's Los Angeles mansion. They were in New York, Carey and her two children. The thieves got away with a couple of handbags and sunglasses. The total value of a couple of handbags and sunglasses, $50,000. They'd have to leave with half my house to get $50,000 worth of stuff from my house. Amazing. Anyway, I want to get back to Hebrews 12. I was talking about that in the first hour. It says, therefore, since we have been surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. I love that word, marked out for us. I love the fact that God's got a race marked out for us. And, of course, the word race is the word agnon, which means agony. So life is tough. And even when you think that your plan isn't happening, that doesn't mean there isn't a plan in place. It's the plan God has marked out for us. So let's fix our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. It is 6 minutes after the hour. We will take a little break, and then when we come back, Adam Holtz is with us. Very much looking forward to finding out what Adam's been seeing in the movie theaters. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It is 8 minutes after the hour. So glad you are with us today. I have Adam Holtz on the line from Plugged In. Adam, good morning.
Good morning, Bill.
So nice to hear your voice. Thanks for being on the show today.
Always enjoy being on.
Yeah. Now, you're in Tinseltown all the time in your work. And the biggest news story the last week has been Mr. Weinstein. So I don't know if you want to comment on that, or maybe you'd like to talk about Lulu, the bomb-sniffing dog that wasn't motivated. You can take your pick.
Well, I don't know about the bomb-sniffing dog. Clearly,
I thought you were listening. Okay.
And, you know, I think that there's so many angles to the Harvey Weinstein story, but I think at the core, what we have is a story about sin. And I think that when people are surprised, when people act badly, perhaps it's because we've lost track of the fact that we live in a fallen world. And that is not in any way at all to excuse the horrible things that he has allegedly done. But, you know, clearly he had power, he had influence, and he used those in really selfish and perhaps even compulsive ways. I mean, when I hear these stories, it sounds like an out-of-control addict to me. And I don't know what's going to happen with him, but I think, you know, the good news of the gospel is that there is always space for forgiveness and there's always space for redemption. And I don't know how Harvey's story is going to turn out. I don't know how the stories are going to turn out of the women that he, you know, reportedly treated so horrifically. But for all of them, I think that there is room for redemption. And you know, maybe that sounds Pollyanna. You know, is Harvey going to have a come-to-Jesus moment in prison if he ends up there?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Probably not.
Yeah.
But I think that the gospel is there for all of us, rich, poor, powerful, fallen, and I think it's just a reminder. But for the grace of God, all of us get entangled in sin. I love that you just read that passage from what was it, Hebrews?
Yes.
About throwing off the sin that so easily entangles, and you know, the second I feel like getting on my high moral horse and throwing Harvey under the bus, I guess that's kind of a mixed metaphor, huh?
But, yeah.
You know, I need to be really careful, you know, and that's not my issue, thankfully. Mine are more mundane and probably less criminal.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Anyway, I think it's a tragic story.
Yeah, I do too.
You know, there you go.
Adam, does a player this big, though, does it have any effect on Hollywood? Does it hit the reset button in a way? Does it,
you know,
does it start to reshape how people are, movies that are being made, or the direction that is coming out of Hollywood?
That's a terrific question. I'm sort of a voracious internet fiend myself, and I've read a lot of stuff on both sides of that question. There are a lot of people who feel like this really is a sea change in terms of how Hollywood does business, and there are others that basically say, you know, it's sort of like, in some ways, there are parallels with the mass shootings, and that every time we have a mass shooting, you know, we think, this time we're really going to change things. This is never going to happen again. And these people have said, probably there are more Harveys out there who haven't been outed.
Mm-hmm.
They still have power. They still have influence. There are still these young actresses who want to get work, who don't want to do anything to jeopardize their career, who might be willing to kowtow toward them, to them, or even unable to resist if these men do something really violent, like, again, that Harvey's been accused of doing. So my guess is it's somewhere in the middle. I think that we're going to see some real changes, but human beings are still human beings. We're still living in a fallen world, and so, you know, I don't know that the changes are going to be that radical. And as far as Harvey's influence, you know, there's always another kingmaker in the wings waiting to step in and take the reins of power.
That's so true. That's so true.
There you go.
Well, I know people are headed to the movies this weekend, so let's give them some advice. What about Same Kind of Different as Me?
Same Kind of Different as Me is a rare bird, Bill. It's pretty rare that I come on and say, go to this movie. I'm going to say that about this one with one very mild disclaimer in just a minute. But if you're not familiar about it, this is the story of a Fort Worth art dealer named Ron Hall. It's based on a true story. And he and his wife were in a pretty bad place. He had had an affair and confessed that to his wife, and they were trying to sort of patch things up. She is a really devout woman, but her devotion is evident primarily in what she does, not in what she says. She's a pretty quiet woman in some ways, and she starts taking him down to a homeless shelter in Fort Worth to serve, and they have a lot of money. They're very rich. And he doesn't really want to get his hands dirty. He basically just says, "Why, you know, can we just write a check? Is that good enough? I'll write it for any amount you want." But it's not good enough for her. And they meet a man who he's known on the streets as Suicide. And they eventually learn his real name. His real name is Denver Moore. And slowly, Ron and his wife, Debbie, and Denver build this pretty amazing friendship. And hear Denver's story. And Denver's story is pretty horrific, and that's the slight disclaimer. He grew up in the South, and there's some pretty awful things that happened to him. So I'm not sure I would take the youngest of young children. This is a PG-13 movie. But I think, you know, for young teens and maybe even mature tweens on up, this is a story about every individual's dignity. It's a story about how when we just do simple things and demonstrate love to people, it can change their lives. And I loved it. I sometimes think Christian movies can be a little bit sentimental, a little bit schmaltzy.
Mm-hmm.
This one isn't that. It
yeah.
felt very genuine to me. And it stars Greg Kinnear and Renee Zellweger. The guy whose name I can never pronounce as Denver, Jaimin or Jaimin Hansu.
Yeah.
Forgive me for butchering his name.
That's okay.
Anyway, this one is worth seeing if you
okay.
want to inspiring story, go see it.
Yeah. Did you ever have to reach for a Kleenex or at least pull out part of your sleeve?
Well, I was busy taking notes, so probably not.
Okay.
I have been known to shed a tear in movies, but usually when I'm working, that emotional core is sort of at least pushed to the side a little bit so I can make sure I get my notes accurate.
That's good. All right, Adam, I want to take a break, and then I want to talk about Only the Brave, which is, I think, a firefighter movie, and Goodbye, Christopher Robin, and if we have time, a movie called Marshall. I'm talking to Adam Holtz from Plugged In. I'll take a short break and be right back.
I couldn't sleep at all last night.
Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Speaking to Adam Holtz from Plugged In, and we're talking movies. Adam, let's talk about Only the Brave. That's a firefighter movie, isn't it?
It's a firefighter movie. I don't know if you remember back. We can rewind our brains a little bit to late June in 2013. You may remember hearing a story about a forest fire outside of Prescott, Arizona, that took the lives of 19 firefighters. And this is a movie that tells their story. And, you know, right there you might think, okay, I know how this ends. You know, it's sort of like the Titanic or, you know, maybe not like the Titanic.
I didn't know how the Titanic ended. That's why.
You didn't know?
No, I did not know when I went.
It must have come as a shock to you.
Yeah, I did. Oh, believe me.
Anyway, I think sometimes with these tragic stories you might think, why would I want to go see a downer story like that? And it's a legitimate question, but really the fire part of the story is only a relatively small part of this movie, but it's a pretty inspirational story. In some ways it reminded me of almost like Top Gun, only with firefighters. It's about a municipal wildland firefighting crew led by a veteran named Eric Marsh. And I didn't know this, Bill, but there's this whole hierarchy of firefighters. And you hear about what are called hotshot crews, and that's not just somebody being snarky. That's what they're called. It's a proper noun. And being a hotshot crew is a big deal, and Eric felt like his crew had what it took to become a hotshot crew. And hotshot crews travel all over the country. They may even go to Canada as well. I'm not sure. So he basically wants to get his crew certified, but it's really difficult, it's expensive. And actually a municipal local crew had never been certified as a hotshot crew up to this point. And so it kind of tells the story of the Granite Mountain Hotshots. They do eventually get certified. And in the midst of that, there is one young character played by Miles Teller who is kind of trying to reform his wild ways. There are some really great messages, I think, about overcoming addiction. It's a really pro-family movie. I'm hard-pressed to think of a movie that raises up fatherhood and marriage and the value of children as much as this one does. Now, you might be thinking, man, that sounds terrific, and all those things are really good, and for those reasons, I really liked it. There's a lot of profanity. And there's a fair bit of kind of ribald locker room talk as some of the guys talk about some of their conquests romantically and otherwise. So it's not without some things that actually caused us to give it a 2 in terms of our rating for it. But I think if that kind of stuff is content that isn't terribly disturbing to you, I think there's a great story here. So it's one of those that I wish it had less profanity than it did because it keeps us from being able to just flat out say, go see this movie. But for some people, that's a huge issue. For other people, that's not quite so bothersome. So depending on where you're at with that content, it could be a contender for the weekend.
I wonder when they're adding in profanity, if they're doing it because it truly represents what's going on with the firefighters and it's really how they talk, or
yeah,
they have to know they're scaring away people. as well?
Well, you would think so, and I actually brought that up in my review in a little bit different way, that I'm sure that when firefighters are out in the middle of a forest fire, they aren't saying, golly gee, a tree's about to fall.
Right.
You know, I'm not that naive. But I also think in the name of realism, they've included content that really probably will be a turnoff to some people. And so they're making a judgment call on, you know, the kind of content that they think they need to include to tell the story. And I don't know that in this day and age anybody outside of evangelical Christendom is particularly worried about profanity. I think we're sort of the last man standing in that battle.
Sure.
Anyway, yeah, it's one of those things. I'm like, yeah, it's probably mostly realistic, but I wish they dialed it down a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Adam, let's talk about Goodbye, Christopher Robin.
Yeah. Well, you know about Winnie the Pooh, right?
Yes, I do.
I just want to check.
I appreciate it.
Thing.
The Titanic thing fooled me, but the Winnie the Pooh I do know about.
Winnie the Pooh is written by author A.A. Milne, and you might not think that such an iconic, lovable, fluffy, innocent character might have been inspired by kind of horrific events, but Alan Milne was a well-known playwright. He came back from World War I, really a pretty damaged individual, and had a young son whose name was, in fact, Christopher Robin, although, weirdly enough, they call him Billy Moon. That's actually what they call him. I'm not sure. You know, the British, you know, they name their child Clive Staples, and then they call him Jack. I don't understand British naming conventions. I'm just going to go on record with that, right? Anyway, he has this little bear, Winnie the Pooh, and a bunch of stuffed animals, and the family moves out to the country for Alan, for A.A. Milne to just sort of try to get healing from his post-traumatic stress disorder after the war. He's struggling to write. His wife says, if you're not going to write, I'm not sticking around. And she doesn't leave him, but she goes back to London. And so father and son are, you know, left on this, it's not a 100-acre woods, it's about a 500-acre woods. And they kind of discover each other. And that becomes the inspiration for Christopher Robin and for Winnie the Pooh, and that's great as far as it goes, but much of the story has to deal with the fact that this young boy ends up feeling objectified by the media because everybody knows he's the inspiration for this story that everybody loves. And so it kind of is the story of when you're famous and when your kids are famous and when you use them to promote your fame, what kind of an effect does it have on them? And it's a really bittersweet story because there's some pretty hard stuff that father and son have to work through. I think it's a, relatively speaking, it's a pretty nice movie, but it might add a layer of detail to the, you know, the sort of Winnie the Pooh origin story, if you will, that most people would be surprised is as complex and as hard in some ways as there is. And you know, I think for us in the YouTube age, there are lots of kids whose parents are using them right now on YouTube to promote stuff. And so I think there are direct parallels today for what are we asking our children to do? Are we somehow objectifying them? And what might the damage be? So pretty interesting, pretty gentle, but kind of bittersweet and sad movie about the origin of Winnie the Pooh and Christopher Robin.
Yeah, that is really interesting, Adam, and nicely explained. I think probably my favorite Winnie the Pooh line is, if you live to be 100, I want to live to be 100 minus one day, so I would never have to live a day without you.
Well, personally, I like Heffalumps and Woozles in one
day. Nice. Adam, I always love talking to you. Thank you so much for being on the show. Look forward
Thanks,
to our
Bill.
Next visit.
Well,
yep, have a great day.
Talk to you soon.
You bet. 26 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back.
Just one look at you, and I know it's gonna be a lovely day.
When a teenager is causing problems in the family, he isn't the only one in need. Moms and dads desperately need support as well. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. In the heat of relentless family conflict, most moms and dads become battered, worn down, or even devastated. I've known lots of parents who are dying on the inside, but too embarrassed to reveal their weaknesses to others. If that's you, get over it. You have to talk to someone. Get a coffee with a trusted friend. Or if you know someone who's struggling with a hurting teen, invite them over. You don't have to be a counselor or therapist. In fact, don't give advice. Just listen. Your simple gesture of kindness will bring immeasurable hope and strength to a friend in need.
Look for the new book from Mark Briggs entitled Leaving a Legacy of Hope when you visit ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us this morning. I have got George Barna on our studio line. He's a researcher and an author. He has written over, I think, 50 books. And I would say I have read approximately 50 books. So we should have a stimulating conversation. He's got a new book out called The Day Christians Changed America, How Christian Voters Put Trump in the White House and Redirected America's Future. Good morning, George.
Bill, it's good to be with you.
Thank
you.
Know,
I was thinking for people like you, I should put out a picture book.
I wish you would. All right, 50 books, George. You got some ambition and spare time on your hands or something.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. All right, why is this? This is like your first book about politics. Why now?
Well, you know, I was heavily involved in the 2016 election. The organization I work with was engaged with a lot of other organizations in that election season. I'd been a pollster for one of the candidates, a strategist for another, did polling for about 75 different organizations over the course of the two-year campaign cycle, spoke at a bunch of the campaign events, knew a lot of what was going on. So after the election day, I was really intrigued to read all the analyses of people who were supposedly in the know about what really happened. And I was fascinated by the fact that none of them were talking about the role of faith. And having been so heavily involved, I knew that you could not understand the 2016 election unless you understood the role that faith played in it. It played many different roles in many different ways. So I thought, well, given my experience, all the research that I did with the surveys across the country for 2 years related to some of the Senate races, the presidential race, and so forth, that it might make sense for me to put that book together. So that's really what it is. It tells about the role of faith in the 2016 election.
All right, that's a good place to start. Can you start giving us a little bit of an understanding of how faith did play a role in these elections?
Yeah, I mean, no matter what you look at in the campaigns, you find that the positions that candidates took on the issues were affected not only by their own faith, but what they perceive the faith of others would have them to believe or to do. You look at the voters, and their worldview, of course, everybody's worldview is what causes us to do what we do, to think what we think. That worldview is largely shaped by our faith. And so as people who were going to vote looked at the issues, as they evaluated the candidates, as they thought about the parties, as they tried to figure out whether or not the media was giving them truth or fake news, their faith played a major role in that discernment process. You look at media, for instance, and you find out that the Christian media in this particular election played a very large role in educating and influencing voters across the country. You look at the whole idea of the scandals that were related to each of the candidates, major candidates, Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton. We wouldn't know what a scandal was if it weren't for the Bible teaching us right from wrong. So, I mean, no matter what you looked at, that and many other things helped us to shape the events that took place, to have opinions about and responses to the candidates that were running, and even in terms of our choice of issues that we thought were most important and what positions candidates should take on them.
Mm-hmm. George, your book talks about sort of introducing a new faith segment, SageCons. Maybe you'll tell our listeners who they are and what that stands for.
Yeah, it's actually an acronym for Spiritually Active Governance Engaged Conservative Christians. So in other words, these are Christian individuals who have a conservative view of the scriptures, of politics, of life, and because they take the Bible at face value, they believe that the Bible teaches that as a follower of Christ, we're supposed to try to have a positive influence on every sector of society that we can have influence on. So that would naturally include politics and government. So this is a group of people who their lives are not only directed by and deeply guided by their faith, but they take politics and government seriously, so they're better informed than most other segments of the population that we study. They get more heavily involved in elections and in government processes. If they don't, in other words, just turn out to vote, that's important, and they do that.
Mm-hmm.
But they do a lot more than that. They might volunteer, they might donate, they might hand out voter guides, they'll talk to other people about the candidates and the issues. They really get into it. What we found is that that particular group of people is hugely important in elections. It's a group that the media don't talk about, other polls don't track. They're roughly 10% of the voting population, which means if you're a conservative candidate, you cannot win an election only by winning sage cons.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of the coin, though, you also cannot win an election unless you win a large share of sage cons. They're very influential beyond their numbers.
Okay, George, I don't think this is going to be a 7-10 split for you, but you talk about these conservative Christians, and they had very little interest in Donald Trump when he said he wanted to run for president. But by the election day, oh my goodness, there was overwhelming support. What caused that turnaround?
Yeah, you know, when Mr. Trump announced his candidacy 2 months into his run, 91% of sage cons planned to vote against him. By election day, 93% voted for him. Now, I've been a campaign manager. I've been a pollster for numerous candidates over the years, working three presidential candidates. This is unprecedented. I've never seen a turnaround for any candidate like that. So what caused it? There were a couple of things. Number one was an extreme distaste for and fear of Hillary Clinton getting elected. That was the second most important reason. The first most important reason were the positions that Mr. Trump took on the issues that mattered the most to conservative Christians. And the nature of those issues had changed over the course of the campaign. Early in the first days of the campaign, we found that things like religious freedom and immigration and the economy, those were the key things to religious conservatives. But as they listened to all the candidates, they took a deeper look at our culture and really understood what was going on. The key issues shifted to the Supreme Court nominations and the position on abortion. And Mr. Trump came out looking really good compared to Mrs. Clinton on those. And so that was the primary reason why they voted for him.
Mm-hmm. Now, you being in the middle of all of this, I'm just curious as to where this election left you.
Well, I'm still back here in the Socialist Republic of California.
I love it. But
I don't.
Yeah.
It was a fascinating election to be involved in because you saw so much anguish on the part of Christian voters. You know, when Christians choose a candidate, they do it different than other voters in our country. They look first and foremost for character, because they believe that all the choices that a person makes springs from one's character. So if you understand their character, you have a better chance of predicting what kind of a leader they're going to be like, what kind of positions they're going to take, what they're going to do for you or against you. The problem was in this election, when they got down to the two major candidates, they didn't like the character of either one of them. They looked, for instance, at Donald Trump. Only 1% of sage cons believed that Donald Trump had godly character. Now, that sounds awful, but when we did the same character study with Mrs. Clinton, sage cons didn't even give her 1%. So,
wow.
You know, they're looking at two candidates that they thought, oh, my gosh, they're not even in our universe. What are we going to do? So it was fascinating to see the kind of gyrations that everybody had to go through to get to the point where on election day, 91% of sage cons turned out. And again, I've been doing this for 40 years in elections. I've never seen any group of voters, any segment, where 91% turned out. I've actually worked for candidates where 91% of his family didn't turn out. and then you get to not only did 91% turn out, but 93% of them voted the same way. Absolutely startling information. So, Yeah, I mean, it was a lot of fun, actually, to do all the polling, except when I looked at what the local church was doing, because we did a lot of surveys with the pastors of theologically conservative churches, and we found that basically those churches said, we don't want to have anything to do with this election. We don't like the candidates. We don't want to be involved in politics. We don't want our people being muddied up by all this. And so the sad part was that we found that a huge share of their own congregants were virtually begging their pastors not to tell them who to vote for, not to tell them which party was better, not to tell them what the key issue should be, but to teach them how to think biblically about the issues so that they could make up their own minds. And the sad part is that a large majority of theologically conservative pastors refuse to even do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you want to look at it just in job terms, that's their primary job.
Mm-hmm.
But they were concerned that they'd lose people, they'd lose money, they might lose their job, and so they didn't get involved. That really has to change if America is going to be restored to God in the future.
George, let me take a little break. I'm speaking to George Barna. His new book, The Day Christians Changed America, How Christian Voters Put Trump in the White House and Redirected America's Future. Take a short break and be right back. Welcome back to the show. I have on our line George Barna. His new book, The Day Christians Changed America, How Christian Voters Put Trump in the White House and Redirected America's Future. We're talking about SageCons. And again, I've already forgotten what the acronym stands for. But, George, maybe you remind our listeners what it stands for?
You do need that picture book.
I really do.
Yeah, Spiritually Active, Governments Engaged, Conservative Christians.
Okay.
So, in other words, their faith is really what guides all the decisions they make in their life. And more so than other people, they understand that government and politics makes a difference. And by the way, the reason it makes a difference, you know, so many people have this mistaken notion. They say, well, you know, you can't legislate morality. And nothing could be further from the truth. That's the exact opposite of reality. Because what government does is make laws, and what laws do, they make them and enforce them. And what laws do is they tell us right from wrong. That's what morality is,
mm-hmm.
discerning from wrong. And so the only thing that government does, really, is engage in morality. And that's why we have to care about government, is because they are teaching our kids, they are affecting our lives in terms of morality.
Mm-hmm. So the SageCons showed up in droves to vote for Donald Trump. How are they feeling about him today?
You know, it's interesting. He's retained most of them, even though they kind of have this concern in the back of their minds about, oh my gosh, what's he going to tweet next? You know, that doesn't go over too well with them. But when they look at what he's actually been doing as the chief executive, they're pretty pleased in terms of what he's been doing for religious freedom with the Supreme Court, the efforts related to Obamacare, repealing many of the laws and executive orders that Mr. Obama had put into place. The mainstream media doesn't talk very much about what he's actually accomplished. But through other forms of media, which is another interesting outcome of the election, so many SageCons around the country are actually tracking what's going on. And I think our most recent poll showed that about 70% of them say that they are very supportive of him, and an even higher proportion say they're pleasantly surprised at how he's done so far in office.
In your book, you talk about a New York meeting of conservative Christian leaders. And that was a turning point for putting their support behind Donald Trump. What was that meeting about? What made it so significant?
Well, that happened in the middle of 2016. In June 2016, there was this meeting that took place in Manhattan, and the genesis of it was the parent organization that I worked for, United in Purpose, got together with another ministry, My Faith Votes, and the two of them had great concerns about the fact that so many major well-known Christian leaders were saying, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with this election. I don't believe in either of these candidates. And the problem was, by them saying that they were going to sit it out and they would essentially encourage their following to sit it out, that would hand the election to Mrs. Clinton, which given the kinds of issues that conservative Christians care about, that would have been a disaster. So the idea was, what if we have an invitation-only event where we bring together major Christian leaders from across the country who are on the fence? They're either planning to sit it out, or they don't know who to support, can't make up their minds. We don't want the people who've already made up their minds. Good for them. Go do what you got to do. But for those who are planning not to play the game, you got to get in the game. So let's bring Mr. Trump in, and in a separate event, let's bring Mrs. Clinton in. You can talk with each of the candidates in a closed-door, no-media-present kind of event. So we went to put those together. We invited Mr. Trump. He said, yeah, I'll give you 45 minutes if you do it in Manhattan on a day that works for me. We asked Mrs. Clinton. She said, I'm not interested. So we put together the event for Mr. Trump, and he came down, and it's a long story. I go more into it in the book, but essentially he came out. It appeared that he was preparing for the worst. He probably thought, my gosh, there's 1,000-something significant Christian leaders here. And by the way, this group represented, as best I can tell, roughly 60 million Americans in terms of the audience, the constituency that they reach. So it's a very potentially powerful group. He came in, he was probably expecting them to blast him for all his sexual exploits, his language, you know, all kinds of other things. But you know what? He said he'd give us 45 minutes. He made 15 minutes worth of statements. Mike Huckabee, you know, asked him questions, and he'd respond to them. And then they opened it up to questions from all these Christian leaders. And you'd have people like James Dobson and Tony Perkins and Sammy Rodriguez and a whole bunch of others who got up and asked questions. He gave his answers. They asked follow-up questions. There was a really good conversation that took place about what we believe, what he believed, you know, where the conjunction was, where there were issues. And at the end of the day, what we found out from our research with those 1,000-plus leaders was that most of them had not decided, okay, Trump's the man for me.
Mm-hmm.
What happened was their mind was open to that possibility now. And I did find about 6 weeks later with some of the research we did at that point with these people that a large majority of them had decided, yes, Trump is the way we need to go. They'd taken the time to study things, to pray about it, to talk to other people more deeply about it. They came to that conclusion because they run 501c3 nonprofit organizations. They could not tell their constituencies, we endorse one candidate or the other. But they did at that point generally go back to their people and say, you know what, here's where the two candidates stand. They did a comparison. It became pretty clear who was more likely to favor a Christian point of view on many issues. They said, we think you need to give Mr. Trump a deep second look.
Mm-hmm.
And it proved out to work.
Well, I certainly didn't appreciate the derogatory things that Mr. Trump said about women, but I do have to remind myself, at the time he said that, he was a Democrat.
And a liberal.
Yeah, exactly. All right, George, we just have about a minute left. I think the GOP platform was largely ignored by the voting public, and yet you say that platform was very significant. Can you give us one way before we close up?
Yeah. I mean, it was the most conservative party platform that's been developed by either party in at least the last 50 years, maybe longer, but that's all I know about.
Mm-hmm.
So very conservative, and it matters because the party platform becomes the agenda of official positions of the party and its candidates. And so when you look at its stands on family, you look at its stands on life, you look at its stands on the economy, you know, all of these things and more. It was the official standard, and it really did reflect pretty much a biblical worldview about how do we govern people in this country in a particular manner for the next 4 years at least. And it was a pretty startling document put together by a number of Christians who had orchestrated being elected to their state convention and then being chosen by their state convention to go to the national convention as a representative on the platform committee. So it really worked out very well.
Mm-hmm. I've been speaking to George Barna. His new book, The Day Christians Changed America, How Christian Voters Put Trump in the White House and Redirected America's Future. George, thank you so much. If you're not going to say this was your favorite interview ever, thank you for at least thinking it.
Well, I'm drawing pictures here for you.
Thank you. Look forward to your next book, designed particularly for me. Thanks, George.
Thank you, Bill.
Yep, we'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.